Professional in TNEC. He is a vice president of the regional council and a member of its DESN, DESN of America. The topic, teens off the barrel, is something that is perhaps somewhat a little more removed from the manual of DESN. It occurs within our daily lives. Anyone here in the audience, including myself, that has had the privilege of raising a teenager, knows the challenges that we face, the joys and sometimes the difficulties. And while thinking about this topic, just over the last week or two, I heard about something that sort of gave me pause. It seems I read about this Jewish gang in Israel, teenage gang, up in the West Bank, and they came into a town and literally engaged in killing some of the people of that town, looted the place, and then I read the next week that they sold their own brother. Over the last 2 weeks on Shabbos, we read about a gang of teenagers. Shem was an act was perpetrated by Shimon Halevi, which Ish Charbov, he had just turned 13, Rashi tells us. And of course, in this week's parsha, Yosef was all 17, his brothers were maybe a couple of years older than him. Yet somehow the term teen off the derech, we never associate with the Shabbat. Children of Yaakov Avinu, although in their teen years, did some pretty outrageous things that certainly would get them thrown out of any school today, engaging in these types of acts. Yet, I don't think of them in that context. And I thought, why? I came up very briefly with a couple of ideas. One is that there was always a channel of communication with their father. The Shvatim are in constant dialogue with Yaakov Avinu. As a matter of fact, with the story of Dina, what happens is V'yakov shama ki time is Dina bito uvana v'hoyu is mikneu basoda v'hecherish Yaakov ad ho'am. This terrible tragedy occurs, the outrage. Yaakov waits, buys his time until that is to say that he communicates good things in the family, bad things, difficulties, challenges. Then goes into the room with his wife, locks the door, and doesn't talk about that. He involves his children in what's going on in the life of the family. Always an open channel. They disagree, they're rather violent. He tells them, "Acharkem osi, you have harmed me, you have muddied me," and they answer back, they retort. There's not necessarily agreement between parent and child, but there is communication. This, I believe, is one of the key reasons why there is no gap, there's no off the derech, they're on the derech, and they're doing things that their father disagrees with at times. When they're leaving Shem, Vayavil Yaakov as Kalohea Nekar Asher Biyala, they have to leave all of the Abomizara that they captured behind. V'yes Hanizamin Asher Biyaznehem, and the earrings that were in their ears. Whose ears? That's what the Chidol, the ears of the idols. The Alohea Nekar, they were adorned with jewelry. That means that when Yaakov said, okay, no more iPhones right now, I'm going to restrict your use on our iPads, I'm turning off the internet at a certain time, there are going to be parental controls, they went along with it. And the Nizamim, Sharbiel's name, the earbuds that they listened to their music with, that they turned over as well, meaning that there was a sense within the family that the limits that the parents put upon the children are respected. Why? How did they earn that respect? Because they communicated. There's always a way of speaking with parents. And so they did things that any teenager tries and pushes the limit and so on. But there was a manner in which Yaakov still had credence, authority in the best manner. And finally, Vayomer Yaakov Le'ephav Liktu Avonim, as he and Laban are taking their leave and put up this Gal Eid, this pile of stones of testimony, he says to his brothers, he added the stones. Who were his brothers? Says Rashi, Le'ephav Heim Bonav. These are his children, his sons. Shahayilo Achim Nikoshim Elov. His sons, they are brothers to him. They're in it together. Either for good or for bad. Even for tsaros, they're there together, unified. This is why they are on the derech. These teens, we're not worried about them. Yosef can be in an alien environment, a giant, as a teenager, able to withstand the most difficult temptation and somehow make its way in an alien culture. They're not in the streets. They're not hanging out doing things. They are together with Yaakov. Why? Again, there's communication, there's respect on both sides. And he treats them as his brothers. To me, these were a few thoughts that came to me with regard to this topic. And now I'd like to ask our speaker to enlighten us further on today's contemporary themes of the Derech, some ideas that we may wish to think about, and some conclusions. Now, our presenter.
Thank you. Very good. I want to thank Rabbi Shulman for the kind introduction and his really comprehensive overview to the entire topic. It's a delight to be here again. It's a number of years already. Last year, by the way, Rabbi Shulman, when I was here, you were in Eretz Yisrael for the bris of a grandson. He must be turning 1 year old this week. So mazel tov on his birthday. It's a pleasure to be here. It's always a very warm and friendly audience. Someone showed me yesterday that there's a pamphlet handed out in Brooklyn that praise me in a different sort of way, as an indirect builder of 7 shuls filled with my critics. So it's such a holy community, even when they try to maledict and curse you, it comes out the wrong way. I'm a Marbitz Torah in a way I never knew I was. And my critics don't even get along. They need 7 shuls to house them. None of it is true, but it doesn't matter. The unsuccessful often snipe at the successful. Be that as it may, I want to thank the sponsors for tonight, Martin Marco, in memory of his parents, Noah and Esther Marco, and in memory of his aunt, Sylvia Ozer, Alea Mashalom. I want to take as a starting point what Rabbi Shulman said, because in fact, Yosef HaTzadik had many of the indicia of what we would call today a teen at risk. He was raised by a single parent. He was a teenager in a family that did have some strife, as we saw in the Sedra this morning. He could be a bit vain, a bit shallow, a bit self-absorbed. And he was sent away from home at a very early age. So in fact, he was at risk. And yet, as Rabbi Shulman so accurately stated, he was saved. He did not succumb to temptation. So the question is why, and we'll return to that. This is a most weighty topic, teens at risk. It affects people's lives, changes families. There are 2 approaches I could take at the very beginning, and a third I won't take. And the third is to say that there is a group or a philosophy in Jewish life that has the magic bullet, whose children are all wonderful B'nai Torah, tzaddikim, Tamir Chachomim, Yirei Shamayim, etc. There isn't. Ein bayis asher ein shom meis. And I'm sure whether it's in our own families or families that we know, it exists. And one who thinks there's a greater prevalence of children, wandering children, amongst modern Orthodox Jews, or Haredim, or Hasidish, or Yeshivish, or Litvish, or any other Vish, is simply not paying attention. Some communities hide it better than others. All communities hide it to some extent. I'm not going to say that any particular lifestyle affords perfect coverage and security. Experience and data tell us that this is not so. Each style, so to speak, of Torah observance has its advantages and its disadvantages. But within the framework of Torah, say Elu ve'Elu. But there are two basic approaches that must be addressed before we even define the problem. One approach says, what problem are we talking about? And it's not wrong. We do a far better job today of retention than we ever did. If we look at, for example, European society of the 19th century, that existence that we glorify as the pinnacle of Jewish life, facile nostalgia, they had a much higher dropout rate from Jewish life than we have. And the challenges and the allures of those societies were arguably much more powerful than those of today. Haskalah, socialism, secularism, then communism, Bundism, secular Zionism, all drew substantial numbers of Jewish youth away from Torah observance. A century ago, Jews came to America and mostly lost two or three generations of young people off the derech in a dramatic way. So there really is no historical record of Jews tossing tefillin overboard in New York Harbor, but it's undeniable that many who came and were religious had a shallow commitment to mitzvahs, and their children even less. So Jews who were culturally or ethnically Shomrei Shabbos in Europe just became culturally Jewish here, and it did not necessarily involve Shmirah Shabbos, and so their children were lost. If that's the case, what are we whining about? There always was a dropout rate in the homes of Avram Avinu and Yitzhak Avinu. There was a 50% dropout rate. And even in the Midbar with Moshe, there were Jews who stood at Sinai and nonetheless fell off the derech. Some, like Korach, fell off the derech right into the Adama, and he was gone. Apikaris. So how bad was it in the past? And it's important to know that to be able to evaluate where we are today. It's a book that was published a few months ago. I'm in the middle of reading it now. It's a bit of a dry work. It's called The Chosen Few, How Education Shaped Jewish History from 70 to 1492, the years, by two economists, Zvi Eckstein and Maristella Botticini. So I don't accept all their conclusions, and I think their facts are somewhat overdrawn because they rely more on historians than on the Talmud. They don't really have original sources. But the basic point that they make is true because it's obvious. After the Churban, the survival of the Jewish people demanded that Jews be able to read and to write. And most Jews in an agrarian culture, which existed after the Churban for six centuries, could not. And it was only until Jews became more urbanized that education was prized. The point they make is that any farmer who's investing in a child's Torah education is essentially wasting money, because you cannot monetize that, so it would play no role in their lives. So therefore, their conclusion is parents who valued Jewish existence educated their children. Parents who didn't. And the numbers are staggering. You don't have seatbelts, but just hold on for a moment. In the year 65 of the Common Era, 5 years before the Second Churban, the Jewish population in the world numbered approximately 6.5 million souls. 6.5 million souls. A mere six centuries later, in the year 650, there are approximately 1.2 million Jews in the world. In other words, in 6.5 centuries, we should have been growing like the Chinese. Instead, we lost 5 million Jews. A decline of 80%. It's astonishing. So what happened? They estimate that about half the Jewish population were killed either in wars or in massacres or epidemics. I don't know, maybe it's more. But the other half was lost to assimilation and to conversion. First to Christianity, or especially to Christianity in those years, and then after 650 in the Arabian countries to Islam. We lost 80% of the Jewish people in the 6 centuries after the Churban. That's devastating. So it was worse then. It was worse in the 19th century. It was worse 100 years ago. There have always been Jews who dropped out and assimilated. Being Jewish requires a certain amount of sophistication and discipline and self-control, and the latter two are not really prized, not really valued today. So from that perspective, today is a golden time to be a Jew. That's the first approach. So why is that small comfort to us? There's a second approach. That teens off the derech is a crisis. As you well know, Jews have no problems. We only have crises. It's a crisis. Whatever the rates are, it's small comfort because anecdotally, we all know a family in which the phenomenon has occurred, maybe even in our own. So there's a by now famous Pew Forum study released a few months ago that investigated this area as well. You know, I take it as a snapshot of a moving target with some of the conclusions completely off base, some nonsensical, others inexplicable. If you read it, it's been commented on. According to their survey, 76% of ultra-Orthodox Jews avoid handling money on Shabbos. That means 24% do. I don't know. Maybe the shuls in Brooklyn where if you get an aliyah, you have to pay with cash on the spot for it. 1% of ultra-Orthodox Jews, according to the survey, have a tree in their home every December 25th. Where does a Jew in Borough Park or Lakewood hide that tree from their neighbors? I don't understand. 15% of Orthodox Jews attend non-Jewish religious services several times a year. What are we talking about here? And according to the study, Orthodox Jews are still just 10% of the Jewish population. So our numbers grow and grow. It's obviously that we're growing from the time I was a child, and certainly when you were children, some of you are younger than me also, and yet we can't seem to crack the 10% barrier. So how is that? Well, I don't have complete faith in the findings, but take them for what they're worth. I think they're informational without being completely dispositive or illuminating. On this subject, they reported the following. 83% of Jews under the age of 30 raised Orthodox are still Orthodox. That means a dropout rate of 17%. How do we relate to that? What's 17%? It's roughly 1 in 6. How do we relate to that? Well, it depends, because you crunch the numbers even more. Among Jews raised Orthodox, age 30 to 49, the dropout rate is allegedly 43%. Among those aged 50 to 64, my bracket, the rate is allegedly 59%. Over 65 years old, according to the study, Jews raised Orthodox, only 22% remain Orthodox. Well, clearly the trends are heading in a positive direction, even according to their data, and reinforcing that it was much worse even not too long ago. Personally, I feel that the statistics are slightly inflated. 1 in 6 seems very high. It's not my experience as a shul rav. I would think my dropout rate is less than 10%, probably closer to 5%, if not even smaller than that. What's interesting and true is that Orthodox dropouts, unlike prior generations, think in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, they do not migrate to other denominations. there's no movement, even from teens or young adults off the derech, to join conservative and reform movements. That's not happening. Rather, they defect not to non-orthodoxy, but to nothing. This is different than in older generations when there was such a migration, but leading me to conclude that the classifications they used are flawed. What does raised Orthodox mean? What even does attended yeshiva mean? So I went to a yeshiva katana elementary school in the Bronx, and I had classmates in the Bronx, and my class even went to yeshiva with me, whose families described themselves as Orthodox, but their fathers worked on Shabbos. Wasn't uncommon then. So what made them Orthodox, so to speak? I guess the fathers knew what they were doing was wrong, but they felt they had no choice. Well, they belonged to an Orthodox shul. Think back to the 50s and 60s. But the Orthodox shul might not have had a mechitza. And many people might have driven to shul on Shabbos. So again, their identification was Orthodox, which made them Orthodox for the study's purposes. But by today's standards, that type of Orthodox Jew really no longer exists, or exists in very, very small numbers. But I concede to some, 1 in 6, or 1 in 10, even 1 in 20, 1 in 25, lost is a crisis. To the family in which it happens, only one such child is a calamity. And I think part of the discontent, I have to say it, is that yeshiva tuition is so exorbitant, it's as if there's some implicit covenant that is broken when a child emerges from the yeshiva system and is no longer religious. That is to say, the deal is, we'll pay you $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 over 12, 13, 14, 15 years of Jewish education. At the very least, make sure our child is a Shomer Torah u'mitzvos. So there are basically these two approaches. The world is ending. This is a catastrophe without parallel in Jewish history. Or it was always like this. Even worse than this. If anything, it is far better now. Which is it? Okay, I'll embrace both. It isn't as bad as people think. Part of the dropout rate is clearly attributable to the price we pay for living in a free society. We all have bechira chofshis. It's a core principle of Torah. We have free choice. The question is, why do we lose anybody? Why would we lose Jews? And I want to emphasize at the very beginning, before I go into the causes and the conclusions, some teens off the derech come back in their 20s. There's no absolute. You know, they feel their oats. What is it? They sow their oats. And they return. Sometimes because they find a new road back. Other times because they want to marry. And they know that family and community, our families and communities, are most stable, even if imperfect. So they do come back. To say someone is off and gone is an exaggeration. Not everyone comes back, but I've seen people come back. I'm sure you have as well. But the question is, why do we lose any? So for this, I offer a number of reasons, close to 10, with this crucial caveat. There is no one reason, and there is no one group to blame. And sometimes the whole notion of blame is misplaced. There's no one group to blame, whether it's parents or rabbis or mechanchim or society, etc. I believe these reasons, though, will encompass most of the Jews who fall off the derech, and almost all of them are avoidable to a great extent. But when I speak of parents and teachers, I'm being observational, not critical. One of my members used to say, I'm an observant Jew. I observe things. I mean, it's observational. It's not critical. No one had better parents or teachers than Esav HaRasha, and it didn't work out for him for whatever reason. So we can divide these causes into three categories: parents, teachers, and environment. And there'll be some overlap. First parent, parents. The average parent loves his or her child. That goes without saying. So what can go wrong? Let me suggest a few possibilities which can occur either wittingly or unwittingly. First, and very importantly, we have to raising each child exactly the same is a bad approach. It's bad parenting. Indeed, Rav Hirsch, Kedarko, Bakodesh, was critical of Yitzhak and Rivka for not recognizing or not implementing the notion that their two boys could not be raised the same way. And that's the pasuk in Mishlei. Chanoch lenar al pi darko. You have to educate your child according to his way. Darko means his, not ours. His way. What is his way? Meaning, it means his temperament, his personality, his interests. The Gaon says on this pasuk, the Vilna Gaon, ki ha'odom i'efshar lo l'shaber darko. It's impossible to break a person's nature. You can't. You'll break the person, maybe, but you can't break his nature. And the Gra said, everyone is born with certain tendencies, passions, inclinations, and these cannot be changed. They can only be channeled in the proper direction. So the Gaon gives an example from the famous Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Kuf Nun Vav Amud Aleph, that someone born with aggressive tendencies, he likes blood. So the Gemara says he has choices before him. I omana, I ganova, I tabocha, I mohala. He can wind up in one of four occupations. He can be a bloodletter, let's say he's a surgeon. He can be a murderer, a robber, a mugger, a knockout puncher, for all I know. He could be a butcher, a sheikhet, or he could be a mohel. Of the four, three are actually positive. The only bad one is a ganav. But what the Gra says, you have to take the child, see where, in which direction his energies lie, and guide him to a wholesome actualization of those energies. It seems obvious, but it's not. Very often parents harbor dreams for their children that they want realized. Sometimes even unfulfilled dreams of their own. They want to live vicariously through their children. Big mistake. Family businesses, you have to be a doctor, a lawyer, a rabbi. You have to join my company, you have to take over my company. You have to embrace the family hobby. Jews don't really have family coats of arms, right? I guess not. You have to embrace the family charity. It's great to encourage it. But you can't insist on it. Every child has to find his or her own path, and the parent has to realize the child's nature and guide him accordingly. And if not, the child's going to rebel because they're not living their own lives, and they feel their derech, their way in life, being thwarted. This is sometimes more difficult to do than it sounds because of the second problem of parents, what I would call the box. What if the child doesn't fit into the box? What's the box? We all know the box. You go to this yeshiva ketana, you go to this high school, you go to in Israel, you learn, then you marry. You're supposed to find an appropriate profession. So for a woman, one of the therapies, speech, physical, occupational, or some other gainful employment. For men, maybe the same, maybe for women also, doctor, lawyer, business, accounting, rabbi, etc. That's the box. But what if their passions lie elsewhere? Rav Kook writes, it's in his igrot, his letters, it's Chelek Aleph, letter Kuf Nun Ches, 158, that part of the renaissance of Jewish national life, the rebirth of the Jewish people in its own land, is the rebirth of the Jewish people coming to life in art and literature, music, etc. We see this in our own day. There are in Israel today religious Jewish actors and singers and artists and writers and comedians and others as well. They're not in the box. And the box is not for everyone. And the child whose gifts lie in one area and is forced into another, back into the box, is going to rebel. Ki ha'odom i'efshar lo l'shaber darko, the Gros said. You can't break people's nature. And the wise parent finds ways to accommodate those natures and guide them appropriately. Not every child is cut out for the Beis Medrash. But we need Bali Chesed, and activists, and scientists, and builders. In fact, we need Jews to cultivate all their talents. We have enough doctors and lawyers. The other group that's out of the box are children with special needs of a wide variety. Children who are different, children who are not as social, who are not as intellectually gifted, who cannot find their place in our world in the box. Well, we have to find a place for them. And that can be done by giving them other outlets, right? Instead of learning about the Mishkan, let them build a Mishkan. Instead of memorizing details, let them work with their hands and their senses when their minds are not as adept. Let them revel in mitzvos like Sukkah, Pesach. In shul, let them set up the Kiddush. Let them run the Chesed program if they can't sit in davening for 3 hours or can't sit in a shir. Be very wary of the box, because the box confines and it stifles. And ultimately, people try to break out of it. Third, parents have to be clear. Because each child is different, the wise parent has to learn how to be clear about expectations and boundaries, about right and wrong. Of 5 children, 4 might hear the same message, but one needs to hear it a little more often, or a little differently, or be given time to internalize it, whereas others have grasped it immediately. And fourth, I would say, and this is most critical, parents have to be consistent. Consistency. So the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin Aleph, Amud Aleph, speaking about the Ben Sorer Umora, they come to the Sanhedrin about the rebellious child, and they say, Einenu Shomea Bekolenu, he doesn't listen to our voice. Note the phrase, our voice. So the Gemara says that the parents have to present as identical, Bekol, Bimare, Bekoma, in the way they speak, in their appearance, in their stature. That is to say, they have to convey the same message to their children. Parents can often send conflicting and inconsistent messages to our children, who are very sensitive, and they're exquisitely sensitive to the inconsistencies. For example, the level of observance inside and outside the home has to be the same. Inconsistency sends a message to the child that it's really all for show, it's for the neighbors, it's a game. And he or she will then choose not to play the game. What is inconsistency? The parent who tells a child to go learn Torah when he's sitting in front of a television is sending an inconsistent message. In the best circumstance, that child will grow up to be a parent who sits in front of the television and tells his children to go learn Torah. Eventually, I like to think someone is actually going to learn. Who knows how long that will take? Or the parent is preaching honesty, but is in fact dishonest, and boasts about finagling here, a shtick there, and the children pick up on it. Or the parent who insists on respect for authority, when Shabbos afternoon at the table, he bashes the rabbi, whether his or all of them, and then wonders why children have no respect for rabbis or the Torah they teach. Or the parent who preaches about values but is consumed by materialism, by desire for money and for spending, and is jealous of those who have more, have bigger, have newer, etc. That message is internalized very well by children. Sometimes parents are unhappy when their children turn out exactly like they do. They're the same. Maybe they want it better for them, but they're the same. So I thought about this. I reminded myself of an amazing little vignette in my own life when I was a lawyer many moons ago. I was one day walking through the courthouse in the Bronx, and I saw an older lawyer, older, now he was probably my age, but this is 30 years ago, and he was downcast. So I said to him, what's wrong? Why are you so downcast? He said to me, I'm sad because my son is marrying a guy. So I said to him, I'm sorry to hear that. So he said to me, I guess I can't blame him, so did I. So as I do the computation, you know, the calculations in my mind, I realize that he is upset because his non-Jewish son is marrying a non-Jew. So I said to him, you know what? Sometimes you have to support them in their happiness. And that was it. Why? Because he knew it was a different generation. So when he did it, there's no justification for it. But when he did it, maybe there's pressure from family, right? Maybe the community was unhappy. Maybe they sat shiva for all we know. But he had none of that because he'd done the same thing. So that's an extreme case. But nonetheless, there could be parents who are unhappy when children turn out exactly the way they are and they don't like what they see in them. And worse, and this I feel necessary to say because I've heard it from a number of people, children can be turned off to shul by watching how their parents and other adults behave. I've heard this from too many people I care to recount. Kids will say, kids, sometimes late teens, sometimes early 20s, and they just write off the notion of Tefillah B'Tzibur, among other things. The people they go to shul to talk, to show off their outfits, to catch up with their friends. So why should I go? I'll dress the way I want to dress, and I'll meet my friends in my house. Why come to shul? So the child who sits next to the parent in shul, and the parent talks incessantly, and when the child talks, is shushed, so he's going to react negatively to the shul. With a child, a young child, is forced to sit through a long davening at too young an age, so they'll grow up to hate the shul. They want no part of it. Besides the talking, we all know, there's drinking, and children see adults in shul, and they come back from musaf, not here of course, not even in my shul, but I've heard about it. They come back from musaf, and they're a little tipsy, and a teenager picks up on it. This is shul. I mean, I heard from a teenager once, Nebuch, a person's in his 40s now, completely irreligious, had to hold his father on the way home from shul every Shabbos because he was intoxicated. He's not going to shul anymore. Who could blame him for that? So if given the choice, they just stop coming. Consistency is the hallmark of the Jew. That's why we have daily obligations. Daily avodas Hashem. Three tefillos a day, Talmud Torah every day. We have tefillin and tzitzis. We have a weekly Shabbos. Consistency. All teenagers are turned off to hypocrisy. And inconsistent behavior just stokes those flames. And even one act of extreme or transparent inconsistency can leave a mark that just opens years later unless it's addressed openly and honestly at the time the child discovers it or asks about it. And parents can become defensive. I don't owe you an explanation. I'm the parent. You're my child. It's all true. But then again, the grown child will owe his parents no explanation as well about his or her lifestyle. There are other aspects of parenting. I want to move on to the role of the teacher. A teacher, I mean the Rebbe, the rabbi, the role model. We entrust so much of our children's future to them, and yet we have to keep in mind the primary responsibility always remains with us, with parents and with the home. But there's one major way in which teachers can ruin children. There's a very famous book that was written in the last decade that anyone interested in this area should read. It's really well done by a Persian Jewess named Farinak Margulies called Off the Derech. And she suggests several ways that teachers, Rebbeim, ruin children. One, when they exhibit poor midos, when they are blatantly unfair in class, you know, calling out one kid for something and exempting someone else, favoritism in terms of grades or attention or based on how much money, how wealthy the parents are, unreasonable behavior of teachers. But there's one thing that she said is the worst of all offenses that I've heard as well from people, and that is not answering questions. To her, it was the most common reason cited for children going off the derech. Having asked questions at an impressionable age, at a defining moment in their lives, and being brushed off or slapped down with insults like "you're a shegitz, you're not bikaris, no one would dare ask a question, we don't ask such a question in our yeshiva, get out of class." And we, meaning good people, don't ask such questions. You should be embarrassed that you do. Well, they're questions that preoccupy the thinking teenager, like, how do we know there's a God? How do we know God gave the Torah to the Jewish people? There are many religions out there. How do we know ours is true? And if there's so many, why must I follow this one and not something else? How do we know the Torah is accurate? How do the Torah Shebaal Peh is accurate? How is turning a light on Shabbos considered work? Etc., etc. Many, many other such questions. And sad to say, but I've realized this also, a lot of teachers are not equipped to answer those questions, and so they're tempted to dismiss them with a cavalier or off-putting remark or just an insult, leading the intelligent child to conclude that there are no answers, that it's just a matter of belief, and I don't believe, so leave me alone. A good message for such a teacher would be what Chazal say in Derech Eretz Zuta in the third parak, "Lemad lishoncha lomar eini yodea." Teach your tongue to say, "I don't know." Shemot izbade v'techaz, lest you start to fib or to fudge, and you'll be caught. And they'll know you don't know, but worse, they'll be ruined by it. The best teachers, the best rebbeim, will tell you that their finest lessons, the most impactful on their students, are those that arose spontaneously from questions that got a discussion going. And this is true for parents as well. It's really true for everybody. It's true for a Jew who works with non-Jews and cannot explain Shabbos to them. That's a deficiency that's unacceptable. So too, a parent should be able to explain not only the how of the mitzvah, but the why of the mitzvah. What's the meaning? What's the purpose? How does this make me a better person? Why should I do it? The parent can't do that. And the teacher can't do that. The child is left to draw his own conclusions. Most things have a purpose. Someone sent me a cartoon a couple of weeks ago of a housewife standing over the sink. Can you still say housewife? I guess you can. Standing over a sink doing the dishes, and the caption reads, "Another day in my life in which I've not found any use for algebra." Okay, I understand. But mitzvos are not like that. Mitzvos define us. Mitzvos sanctify our lives. They give us meaning. They give us a connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But we have to understand the meaning, where it's just a bunch of rote actions that look strange to our fellow citizens. You can't just learn the do's and don'ts of Shabbos, but the why as well, how every detail fit into the system. I could tell I was a teenager, 17 years old, when I read The Sabbath by Diane Grunfeld, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And that same year, I went Shneimer Echa Targum through Rav Hirsch's commentary on Chumash. Made a deep impression on me until today. So, one of the historical failings of yeshivos is the absence of limud hashkafa, a failure to teach about the yesodos, about the ikarim, about Jewish ideas, about Jewish values, of why we are who we are, of why it's important, why is it the Ratzon Hashem, why do the Jewish people exist, what's the dox that make us orthodox. Dox means belief. I don't know about today, I don't think it's much better, maybe a little better, but when I was in high school, we never learned the philosophy of the Rambam, or the Kuzari, or the Agadah and Shas, to which Chazal convey their philosophy and the ideas, and yeshiva is often taken as stories and fables and parables. It's almost light reading to get back to the substance of the Gemara, but it's the exact opposite. How many of our children, the brighter children, are exposed to the writings of Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Kook, Rav Huttner, Rav Dessler? They weren't all on the same page. But let our young people see the brilliance of our Gedolim, how they dealt with contemporary issues, philosophy, Torah, and they'll humbly submit to the Torah. When people see the relevance of Torah to our lives and to the world, so then the Torah is revered, and the child feels a deep and personal connection to it. Looked at a different way, why do children stray? Because they lack emunah. They just don't believe. But emunah has to be taught. Rav Kook said that just like Hilchos Shabbos has to be taught, emunah has to be taught. So parents should talk to their children about Hashem from the earliest age, not just the cliches of Baruch Hashem, Yirtzeh Hashem, but God is the Borei Olam, and God is the Mashiach, and God is the Nosein HaTorah, and God is the Shomer Bris, the God who promised to bring the Jewish people back to Eretz Yisrael from exile, and it's happened. Hashem should be a living part of the house, not an abstraction. One critical way to do that is through brachos. You know, how long does it usually take to say a bracha? The amount of time it takes us to move a fork to our mouths, maybe half a second. The brachos are recited out loud, slowly, and not just on Shabbos, but during the week. And the child sees HaKadosh Baruch who's part of this meal. It's a motzi lech min haaretz, borei pri haaretz. We then recognize Ribbono Shel Olam, and what we're doing is already more sanctified, more consecrated. We bring Hashem to every meal. So that sticks to a child as well. And I'll add one other point, which almost bridges this divide between the parents and the teachers, because it relates to both. It's a problem in Israel especially, and who knows, maybe here as well. Some communities just don't do nuance well. A teenager who is told, for example, that reading a newspaper, going to a movie, is the same as being Michal Shabbos and marrying a guy, they're all Isurim. So when a child then reads a newspaper, he's going to feel that he's doomed. And he might as well be Michal Shabbos and use drugs and be promiscuous. But that's not the Torah. There's a hierarchy of prohibitions. And there's also the possibility of tshuva, of repentance. We should not make anyone feel that if they've done something wrong, they're lost permanently, irrevocably, enemies of God who can never be redeemed or rehabilitated. That's the Rambam Hilchos Tshuva. There's no person who's lost. Teachers or yeshivas where this happens, where there is no recognition of nuance and no tolerance for any type of mischief, they're going to lose some of their students. Sometimes while they're there, and other times when they leave, but they will lose some of them. You have to have some patience as well. I remember there was a bar mitzvah this morning in shul, so I was talking to the boy yesterday, and I said to him, what's your biggest claim to fame? You're 9 years in yeshiva katana. So he said, you know, in all my years there, I've never been thrown out of a class. So I said, wow, that bubble was burst for me in kindergarten, so you're already way ahead of me. Children can be mischievous, but a child is made to feel that he's doomed because he deviates in ways that are really frivolous in the grand scheme of things. It's a big mistake. It's the third leg of this stool, and that's the environment in which the child is raised. Friends, 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 peers, influences. Our children are growing up in a world in which religion is mocked constantly. And we should be aware of what they're hearing and seeing. Where religion is perceived as the source of much of the world's strife and problems. And where religion tries unnaturally to restrain our desires and induce in us a state of guilt and unhappiness. You get those messages long enough and unrefuted, no wonder they flee. It's a very hedonistic age, as we know, which people chafe under any type of restriction. I don't doubt that a good percentage of dropouts are young people just don't want to be told what to do by anyone, even Hashem. Not everyone is a philosopher. And I'm not making this up. This is the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Daf Samech Gimel Med Beis, Yodin Hoy Yisrael Ba'avodah Zarah She'en Ba'mamish. The Jewish people knew there was no substance to Egel Azov. It didn't take them out of Mitzrayim. It had no powers. Lo'ov Ba'avodah Zarah Ela Lahatir Lahem Arayos Befer Hesya. They only served idols so as to permit themselves to be publicly promiscuous. Note, not just arroyos, period, in private, but beferhesya. Because now if they have a religion confirming this ideology of theirs, there's no guilt, because everyone is doing it. It's the passions, it's the desires, it's the inability to exercise self-control. That's what did it. For some people, the restrictions of Torah are just too much. Not because they're overwhelming, but because we live in a world where self-control is just not a value. And self-fulfillment, self-expression are. What feels good is good. So just do it. They may know on some level that a life of moderation is the happiest life, but in the throes of passion, they just don't perceive it. And this is a great challenge because we all strive to create the proper environment. But even friends from the same yeshiva and from the same shul can be bad influences, not good ones. And the parents might not know. So the answer is no. Mi v'mi ha'olchim. Know with whom your child is friendly, with whom he or she associates. And I add to that, there's some yeshivos in Israel that attract doubters. They just do. And they don't always have methods to save them. And we should be aware of that, because if a child is of that bent, it's not the right place for him. And it's certainly not helpful when even in the so-called Orthodox world, we have people questioning Torah Men HaShemayim and Mesorah, etc., Chazal, etc. Because a child can latch on to that and say, oh, I want that for myself, because that seems to be a little more liberal, a little more open. And sad to say, our environment contains another hazard as well. We know in retrospect that there are children who fall off the derech because they've been abused, especially by rebbeim. When children see, physically, emotionally, when children see religious figures behaving badly, they lose respect for the entire Torah. It's wrong, it's immature. You know, the Torah is perfect. No one ever said Jews are perfect. But it's certainly understandable. The disappointment a young person feels when he or she sees a revered Torah figure or parent violate core principles of Torah and sometimes under color of religious mandate and use the Torah as a shield to protect themselves from prosecution, recrimination, etc., that disappointment does not easily fade. So what can be done? As I noted, the reason for children going off the derech are eclectic, they're multifaceted. They're as different as are human beings, one from the other. We all have different deos, different personalities. Sometimes parents contribute to it by being inconsistent, by not always acting in accordance with the values they otherwise espouse, by trying to raise all their children exactly the same, by trying to place everyone in the same box. Teachers contribute to it by not answering theological questions when they arise, by sometimes rudely dismissing and insulting the questioner, by not teaching the why of Torah, by focusing only on the what, by exhibiting bad midos. Teachers do it as well. And the environment is also not always salutary. Friends and peers can be good or bad influences. The society generally mocks religion, sees it as the root of all evil, and rages against restricting any desire, any time. Now, that's not to say, again, that any of the three legs are to blame, so to speak. ultimately everyone has bechira. Normal teenagers go through a stage of rebellion as adolescents anyway, and many do come back. So that should not be dismissed in the crisis atmosphere of where high school, college age kids, graduate school, etc. are religiously. So many come back, as I said, when it's time to marry or start a family, send their own children to yeshiva. They may disappear for a few years and give their parents tremendous agmas nefesh, but they can come back as well. And not everything that we consider off the derech is really off the derech. It assumes there's only one derech. That's not always so. We should have to be a little broader in that sense. The Rosh says in the first Mishnah in Peah, the famous Mishnah, Eilu Dvarm Sheinlem Shiur. The Rosh says, Ke Kadosh Baruch Hu Chofetz Yoser B'mitzvah Sheyase Bohem Gam Ratzon Abrios Mi B'mitzvah Shein Adam Lakono. That God desires more the mitzvos that benefit other people, Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, than just mitzvos between man and God. So we shouldn't scoff at people who observe many mitzvos, just not the ones that are uniquely Jewish. If they're good people, it's easier to bring them back because they'll see how the human conscience is unreliable and how the Torah strives for perfection. I noticed something in Israel this past summer. I never really noticed, but only because I interacted with several people. There are people from people, religious Jews, Shomrei Shabbos, eat kosher. They just don't wear a yarmulke in public. Strange, from our perspective. They don't. Why don't they? Because Israel is a very polarized society. The type of yarmulke you wear defines you as a member of a certain group. All right? Where it's velvet or leather or sruga. They don't want to be defined by a group. They just want to be Jews. So they avoid that completely. Strange. They put a yarmulke on to eat, to say brachos, but not. You say they're off the derech? They're not off the derech. You have to let people sometimes find their own derech and understand the nuances of Jewish life. Do not underestimate also how difficult it is to keep our children in the fold when every week another Jew is arrested for something or accused of something. So what should parents do? One Rabbi Shulman noted before, talk at whatever age. Parents have to talk to children, but really talk. Without the iPhone next to them. You know, no iPhone, yes, eye contact. It's a different type of eye. Without any distractions. In our world, the year in Israel was so critical because for many youth, it was the first time they had a Rebbe who actually talked to them about life issues. This I heard from so many young people. For the first time, I had a question about something, and a Rebbe sat up with them to 1, 2, 3 in the morning to talk about it. Not a problem. An idea, a concept, a philosophy. Parents have to learn to talk from the earliest age and directly, eye contact, and listen to what the child is saying, not just talk. And the second point is love. Rav Kook was asked by a distraught father, whose son had gone off the derech, is he still obligated to love him as he did before? And Rav Kook answered, no. He's obligated to love him more than before because now he needs that love more or he'll be completely gone. A parent's love, the difficult point, should never be conditioned on appropriate conduct. All right, I can see there's some conduct beyond the pale. I just want to change their last name. But that type of guilt, do it because I want you to do it so you won't embarrass me, that type of guilt wears thin over time, especially as a child gets older. Guilt. You have to live in a certain community, you have to practice a certain profession, you can't make aliyah, etc. Guilt is a very weak weapon to employ. It sounds more powerful than it really is. So what idea should be conveyed to children? This could be one all-encompassing principle. Rav Hutner said that a parent should always try to inculcate in a child that he or she is a prince, a princess of the Jewish people, part of an Am HaNivchar. When he said it, you know, princes and princesses were known for their regal conduct, not their lascivious conduct. But he meant it well. A child who feels he's royalty, Because he's part of a royal people, cannot stray. Their self-identity is tied inherently to great things. So give a child a personal stake in being Jewish. A personal stake, not just a familial stake. And above all, Simchas Achayim, the joy of life. The child has to feel the joy of Jewish life and grow up in a happy home. Of course, their personalities cannot be crushed, but they should never feel only the weight of the Shesol Lavin, of the 365 prohibitions. A home that's always on edge, lest someone sin, is not a happy home. Sin is bad, but fear of sin is not supposed to cause stress. A home in which Shabbos is happy and the Yom Tovim are happy and the parents are happy and Jewish life is celebrated, truly celebrated. That's a home in which children will want to remain close to the Torah. So I started with Yosef HaTzadik. How was he able to survive all the indicia of the teen at risk? So just a little over a month and a half ago, a great Rav of Avram Zuckerman died in Eretz Yisrael. Zecher Tzadik Levrach was a longtime head of Yeshiva Ben Akiva's assistant to Rav Neria. So he says, you see the answer to that question in the first words of the second pasuk of the Sedra. Eila toldos Yaakov Yosef. Yaakov invested more time in Yosef. He knew he had talents. He knew he had an outsized personality. Maybe he knew he would need it as well. But it's because Yaakov invested more time in Yosef. So at the moment of truth, of temptation, he the Gemara says, he saw the image, the visage of his father in the window, and he couldn't sin. Child who bears an image of a parent who's perceived as worthy of respect, a grandparent, a teacher, that child stays on the derech, not out of guilt, but out of aspiration. They want to be like that. They don't want to lose the connection to that. I'll tell you one other thing, with this I close. Just finished a few weeks ago a very interesting book. It came out a year or two ago by Senator Joe Lieberman, written with David Klinghoffer, on Shabbos, called The Day of Rest. Very elegantly written. It's written really for non-Jews or non-Shomrei Shabbos, but I tell you, it's invaluable for religious Jews as well. It's a beautiful perspective on Shabbos. At one point, he cites Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, late chief rabbi of the British Empire, who quotes the Alshech, or Moshe Alshech, in the Taras Moshe, on the Kriyashma, on the phrase, V'shinantum levanecha, you should teach your children. So the Alshech asked, what does it say? V'shinantum levanecha v'dibarta, bum. What's the bum? What's the most important thing to teach a child? So the Alshech writes, it's the previous pasuk. You have to teach a child, ve'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha u'v'chol nafshecha u'v'chol modecha. Meaning a parent has to teach a child what the parent loves, and the child will respond to what the parent loves. He says, you should know, leman yudvarecha shinunim, likones belev bincho be'etzem. So inherently, your words will penetrate to your children. What do you need first? Tikablem ata al atzmecha belibcho be'etzem b'shnei yitzrecha. First, you have to love God. Bechol avavcha, v'chol nafshecha, v'chol modecha. And make avas Hashem the cornerstone of what has to be taught to children. When a parent loves God and the Torah and the Jewish people and the child naturally responds. I don't know, maybe that's why the retention rate is so high. When the parent is able to create a happy home, the child invariably wants such a home for himself or herself. Does it always turn out that way? No. So Gemara says in the Moed Katan, the famous Gemara, Rava said, Chaye bone mezone lo bezchusa talya milsa, elo bimazola talya milsa. When it comes to length of life, children, parnasa, it's not always dependent on zchus. It's dependent on mazel, meaning it's not completely within our control. So we need siyata deshmaya, We need God's help, and therefore the greatest tool in the parents' arsenal is tefillah, is prayer. And how many gedolim will tell you that what they did every day is pray for their children. Daven, add to the Shemon Esrei. Pray for their children to be good Jews. Tefillah, combined with our own efforts, focused, targeted, appropriate, should enable us to overcome all the potentially hostile forces arrayed against us and produce for all of us what we want, Bonim uvnevonim, oskim b'Torah uvmitzvos. I thank you all very much for your kind attention. I'm sure there are no questions, so I could just leave. Any question I'm happy to take? Yes, sir. You have time for questions, right?
Yes.
Okay, sure.
Looking around, I see we have a very modern crowd here.
How do you know that?
Looking around. In fact, I'm sitting next to each other. But would you be as comfortable giving this lecture to a Ireland crowd or a Swedish crowd? And
I was defined as a fearless speaker, you know. Yeah, I don't care.
Okay. I know you wouldn't mind doing it, but you think it would be well received?
That's up to them. You know, as a lawyer, I have to say, it calls for conclusion beyond the scope of the question, but I think much of it will be received as well. I hope it will be well received. Is it the same basic issue? Yes, ma'am. Wonderful. So it's important to find someone, a mentor, can intervene. She said she had a child who was off the derech, and she found someone, a Rav at MTJ, who helped bring him back, Moshe Rosenberg, who helped bring the child back. Yes, sir. It's a little different topic. It's beyond the scope. There are only certain number of things that you can do. At a certain point, if it's irreversible and the child evinces no desire to attempt any type of change therapy, then you have to accept the child, but then tell the child, you are no different than any other Jew because we all have desires that are illicit and you can't act upon them. And so you have to try to guide the child in that one area. If there are other areas the child is also straying, it will be the same thing. Try to limit the scope of Avera, but keep the child close. But it's a sensitive issue because it generates so many other topics. But it's really a topic in itself. Yes, sir.
How is it today that so many young mothers go to work and have little children at home? How does that influence them many years later?
It's a good question. The question was, if you didn't hear, so many young mothers go to work today, so how does that influence young children later? Well, it can't help. If a young mother is not present in the child's life at all times, or most of the time, so the child will feel a certain deficiency. Just keep it in perspective as well. You know, every family is different. A family that is suffering under economic hardship, such that the parents are miserable, they won't have happy children either. So you're really stuck. You know, you're pulling the cord at both ends. It has to be done in a very balanced way. You know, others would say to you, well, you want to send the kids to yeshiva, you have to afford the education somehow, so that's what's necessity. There is an Indian as well that, you know, parents want to be able to express themselves, mothers too, in the workforce, but they're obviously dangers. For me to stand here and say there are no dangers and no consequences would be a falsehood, and I would never say such a thing. It's very possible there are dangers. You know, we see it. Look, I see it because I walk mace between the home and the shul every day. I can't remember the last time a white woman, much less a Jewish woman, picked up the children in the our shul nursery school. It's no different here, where you know a lot of our children are learning, you know, Spanish, Portuguese, Polish, Russian. They're polyglots, but they're not learning Hebrew. That's the problem. They're not learning from their parents. And that's a chisaron. Again, that's a bigger discussion as well. Those involve lifestyle issues, life choices, And I don't want to be flippant and say there's a simple answer to it. There's no simple answer. Sometimes you have to weigh costs and benefits in a very, very realistic way and realize money's not everything, but money's also something and people need to live too. Yes, sir. Good question. How do you explain to other children in the house when one child is off the derech? I think one thing that's important is to articulate what the family expectations are for all the children. All right. So even a child off the derech should not expect to be able to, parade into his parents' house on Shabbos and be mechal Shabbos openly. He should be welcome to the home. All right. Obviously, welcome to the home, but he shouldn't be He shouldn't be allowed to define the environment. In a way that ruins it for others. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is that you have to tell the children that brother, sister is going through certain issues. It's a stage. He's deviated from the values that we have. We have to still love him. We have to do what we can to bring him back. But that's not our way. So they have to be able to learn that bit of finesse. To love someone without completely agreeing with them, and to love someone and want to draw them close, not distance them. It's a problem for younger siblings, especially when the older one, let's say the oldest one, goes off the derech, because the oldest child really is a role model for the younger ones. That's a big problem. So that requires then even more of a parent's effort with that older child in the years of birth, the afterbirth. Of course, the problem is, it's with our oldest child. We usually make all our mistakes, and then we've learned from that, but you can't always overcome it. But that's a very serious question, but it has to be done in two ways. You have to try to control the damage, keep defining the environment, express love, and let the other children know that this is not our derech, but we're trying to bring him back. Yes, sir. You have to speak up a little. Yes, you walked in a little late. I started with that. Yeah, let me just ask you, are there any studies that say that there's a prevalence among different communities? No. Don't believe any studies. I started by saying there's no magic bullet. You shouldn't think that if you have a particular lifestyle, you're set. Some communities hide it better than other communities. But there's no community that has a greater range of dysfunction or off the derech than any other. I don't believe any such study. Second question.
What is the effect of the internet?
So again, what's the effect of the internet? I guess it's a separate topic, but I wouldn't, look, it's a problem, obviously. It's also a crutch, because the child who's seeking those things is already troubled. It has to be weighed with all the other factors. If parents are there, all right. If you have hands-on parenting, the internet will not be a problem at all, because the parent knows what's happening. The parent is involved in the child's life. The fact the child wants to explore things that are outside, way outside the world of Torah, means already there's a gap that's developed between parent and child. The gap is the problem. Because if it's not the internet, it's something else. All right, the internet is more handy, but you know what? I don't think there's any vice today in our lives that is not handy. Every vice is handy. Internet is a convenient weapon to attack, and look, a lot of it is nonsensical and problematic. But again, that represents not the cause of the dysfunction, but in fact, the product of a dysfunction that already exists. Yes, sir. That's a very specific question. It's hard to answer only because you have to know the school, the child. Would the child succeed in that school or not? Is the child more socially comfortable there? Is the fear of another school that he wouldn't be comfortable in the new school? You don't know. It's a very specific question.
I grew up in
Right.
And you didn't have everybody listen the same way. Everybody you had some that were better, some that weren't good, some that came from family, some that didn't.
Right, but your question was more special needs child, but I would say that from my perspective, the notion of having elitist elementary schools is a little bizarre. All right? A school is a school. If the child has special needs and can't learn a particular environment, that's one thing. But to say we'll only have, you know, IQs 120 and up, so that makes no sense.
I said
a child has an IQ. We'll only take IQ over 120, so that makes no sense. A child with special needs, they're just learning disabled, and that's not the environment because they'll be frustrated and they'll fail. They need a different environment. But like you said about out of town, where are you from?
Detroit,
that's really out of town. Sorry about the bankruptcy. Sorry to hear about that.
I haven't lived there, I grew up.
No, I understand. I'm not blaming you for the bankruptcy. Right. By the way, a school that it's mixed, that school, each child benefits from other children more than they're harmed by other children. To be monolithic is never good. I don't think it's good. There's diversity in Jewish life, and it should be acknowledged and celebrated. Yes, sir. Rabbi. Can I comment on children from broken homes and the tendency that they have to be at risk? I think the question answers itself. Obviously, a broken home, no one breaks a home willingly, volitionally, in a normal situation. A child that doesn't have either the paternal or the maternal role is going to be missing something. It's hard to impose upon a single parent to assume both roles, but that's what has to be done. The child of a broken home will very often feel unloved. One parent is gone. Will often feel, and it's almost always not the case, somehow they contributed to the breakup of their family, and so they internalize this guilt, and they naturally want to lash out. Depends, of course, on the age of the children. Younger children will lash out, not knowing why. Adolescents already will understand a little more that they were deprived of something great, something important in their lives, and they'll search for it. Sometimes they'll find it in a healthy way, other times they'll think they'll find it, but it's unhealthy. And that is an increasing risk factor. It's interesting, Yerushalmi says in Harios, we say that about Yosef, Demus Diokono Shel Aviv, Nirsal Bachalon, Yerushalmi Harios says he saw also Ikunim Shel Rachel Velea. He saw his mother and his stepmother. Both had passed also, but he saw them as well. So when he saw Yaakov Avinu, it wasn't just his visage. He saw his mother too. He saw both influences. And because he saw both influences, that gave him the strength to carry on. But I think the message is, and I think everyone will agree, we should try to avoid as best we can broken homes. Parents should think long and hard, twice, three times, 30 times, before they desire to find their happiness somewhere else and leave in their wake unhappy children. They should think and think again. Granted, an abusive home is different altogether. It has to be broken. It has to be separated. But a home where the parents are just not finding, you know, they're bored, they're not finding their expression, they fell out of love, etc. They should think long and hard what they do to their children, all right? Do I know parents who stayed together for the children and got divorced when the children left the home? Absolutely yes. Kol hakavod to them. Because they prioritize their children and not their own happiness. Again, abuse is different, and I recognize that. But in the normal situation where there's not abuse, so a broken home is what it is. You know, if the roof leaks and rain falls in, the inhabitants are affected by it. It's no different emotionally. They're affected by it as well. And we have to do what we can in order to avoid that situation. Okay, I thank you all very much.